Yeah, how to follow Ed and Dave this morning. I mean, those guys are great. They're very entertaining. You can see why they're tops in their field. So the only thing I can start out with is a joke my 17-year-old daughter and myself came up with last year. And I got to kind of set this joke up. And as people in Colorado know now, you can grow 6 plants legally in your, so I decided to experiment as being a gardener. And I planted a bunch of seeds, probably about 18 seeds in some pots in my backyard. And I have a yellow lab, and she was a puppy last year. And and she shares the backyards with the seedlings, and they were about this high. And one day there were 18, and the next day we went out and we looked, and there were only like 6 left. And so we came up with this joke. What do you call a dog that eats marijuana? Anybody know? A cannibal. So I gotta tell you, sorry, I know it's kind of lame, but you know, it's what we come up with, and we're just hanging out at night and we're talking about silly stuff. So I hope that kind of segues a little bit. The other thing that I wanted to talk about just before I really start talking about what I'm going to talk about is being here as a member of Normal Legal Committee. I really love being a member of Normal. I am on the listserv. I get the emails every day. And to me, it's an honor and a privilege to be in front of attorneys and other people who are of this caliber. I learn so much every time I come. And it was driven home to me a couple years ago when there was a federal judge opening in Denver, in Colorado. And I once had a federal judge ask me if I would apply. And that was actually in the Gall case. Judge Pratt called me up and asked me if I would be interested in applying to be a federal judge. And I said, no, I'm an advocate. I'm not really a judge material. And he said, well, think about it, because we need more people like you on the bench. So I thought about it. And when the opening came up, I decided to apply. And I contacted the guys, Jeff Green, who's also a really good criminal defense attorney. He's the one that really did all the heavy lifting when we got to the Supreme Court in the Gall case. And I talked to Jeff and I said, hey, you know, he's in DC and he's plugged into all the centers of power in DC, knows all the Obama people. And I said, would you help me? And he said, sure. And he said, send me your vitae. So I sent him my resume and he called me back and he said, you know, being on the Normal Legal Committee is the kiss of death. And I said, great. I'm glad I've been kissed. So anyway, I'm very proud, and everybody should be very proud of being here today. This is like a great organization, and I'm so proud, and I've already learned so much just being here this weekend. But what I'm going to talk about is kind of continue on what Ed was talking about this morning. Are you still here, Ed? Or you might have left. But anyway, I urge you to look at his materials, because the super secret government surveillance is something that's here. It's been here for a while, and the government will not reveal it voluntarily. We all know that if you're practicing in federal court under criminal rules, criminal procedure 12 and 16, the government has an affirmative obligation to turn over the evidence to you that they have against your client. And in Colorado, it's under Rule 16. And obviously, Ed talked to you this morning about Brady, which is kind of the touchstone and the case that everybody cites whenever they're talking about getting discovery and what is exculpatory evidence. And I think the point that he made this morning is incredibly important, and it should be emphasized every time you file a discovery motion, every time you argue, every time you're looking for things, you have to say that Brady doesn't just say it's exculpatory. You have to really read Brady. You have to read the cases that follow Brady and that cite it, because they talk about this could possibly lead to exculpatory evidence. I mean, it's not the government's role to decide what is exculpatory or not. And screw this ex parte or in chambers examination. That's bogus. I mean, sometimes you have to live with it because you can't go up to the judge and say, that's bogus, judge, you're going to do it this way. But you can do it in a very polite way, and you should say, no, turn it over to me directly, but sometimes you have to have these in-chambers reviews. And you have to live with them, but you just have to keep on fighting. You cannot stop. You have to keep pounding motion after motion after motion. The first thing that you should file as soon as you get on a case is the motion to preserve evidence. And you tell the judge, I want an immediate ruling on this, and I want it in my motion that once you, and the judges always approve it. I've never had a judge turn it down. And what you need to do is you need to say, judge, in your order, I need that the prosecutor is required to notify all the agencies, law enforcement agencies that were involved in this case. They have to notify those agencies that they cannot destroy any of the evidence. Whether I get it or not eventually, it's irrelevant, but they can't destroy it. And we're talking about notes, which they always say, yes, I destroyed my notes, and then I wrote my report. Bullshit. Those notes are there. And yes, some cops do destroy them, but other times they're there. And the handwritten notes, the federal cops, the DEA, FBI, those guys do keep their notes, and they do preserve their notes, and there is good 10th Circuit law on getting those notes at least preserved. So get them preserved. You've got to do that right away. You have to have that order, and you have to say, notify the law enforcement agencies, because the order is nothing if the prosecutors are not required to notify their law enforcement agencies that they have to preserve it. And let me tell you, and this is the hypothetical that I put in my materials, and I don't know if anybody read it or not. I'm going to tell it to you anyway, and this is what we're going to go through today. And this is how I got involved in all this super secret government surveillance. So I get a client, and this actually was a state case. It was not a federal case. How many people are familiar with I-70 here in Colorado, coming all the way from the Utah border to Denver, then all the way to Kansas? Well, anyway, I got a client who's one of three people in a van, and they are pulled over about 10 miles west of Denver. So they're almost to Denver. They're it's a little stop just in the mountains before it drops down by Golden. And they're stopped by the State Patrol, and it's a pretext stop. The State Patrol is told to stop these people. They say that they're speeding. And of course, they say they're going 5 miles over the speed limit. And a little aside to this, in Colorado, 5 miles over the speed limit is a zero-point offense. It's a warning. It's a no-point offense. But anyway, so the State Patrol guy stops him. And of course, immediately after he stops him, four or five DEA guys and local cops show up too. And my client is a woman. She's in the van. She's a middle-aged woman. And she's Mexican, or she's Hispanic. She doesn't speak very much English. She's in the van, her sister is in the van, and her brother is driving the van. And the van's got California plates on it. And after kind of hassling these people for a little while, they say, well, you can leave, we want to take the van. So to make a long story short, the cops take the van, they bring it to their headquarters in Golden. They find a hidden compartment, and inside that hidden compartment, they find 10 pounds of heroin. But they let the three of them go. They drop them at a Walmart up at the Evergreen exit up in the mountains, and these people then disappear. And what they do is they find them, they stumble across them back in California, and they extradite them back to Colorado, and it's a state case. So I'm like going, man, there's got to be a lot here. There's got to be more than meets the eye. And the nice thing about practicing in state court in Colorado, you get a fair amount of discovery before you have the preliminary hearing. And the equivalent would be a preliminary hearing or detention hearing in federal court where you don't have any discovery. And you kind of have to wing it and you learn as you go. But in state court here in Colorado, you typically do get a fair amount of discovery before you hit the preliminary hearing. And so I'm going through the discovery and I'm like going, this doesn't smell right. Something's weird about this case. And what I learn when I'm going through the discovery is I'm learning that they had been investigating this person in California that they believed was the head of a heroin smuggling ring, and that they had seen this van and the brother at this person's house in California, and they believed that this van was going east. Then they got all that from their Title III wiretaps. So they knew that something was going on and something was coming down and this van was going to be traveling cross country. And then I also learned that in the discovery, I don't have the actual TAFs, but I've got the synopsis of the TAFs and the reports. And I also learned that the there's conversations that they're having with the people in the van and the guy back in California as they're traveling west, east. And then, so then I've got the DEA agent up who's in charge at the preliminary hearing, and he's testifying. And I asked him this question. I said, how did you know when this van crossed the Colorado-Utah border? Because in the discovery, it says that they started following the van as it crossed in Grand Junction, after it crossed the border. I'm going, this makes absolutely no sense. There's thousands of cars that pass going east on I-70, every hour. I mean, it's a heavily trafficked road. There's just no way that they would be able to pick out this van. He said it was just blind, dumb luck. I'm going, really? So I'm doing that, and I'm going, this makes absolutely no sense at all. There's got to be more going on here than what meets the eye. But remember, this DEA agent now has testified under oath that it was just random, blind, dumb luck that they happened to see the van. So I'm like going, all right, that makes absolutely zero sense. So I start doing a little digging. And what I start doing is I start calling my colleagues in Colorado that do a lot of federal court practice and do a lot of stuff with the DEA. And I'm like going, this really makes no sense. And the one consensus of the word that I found from my colleagues they said, Mark, you need to find out about stingray. I had never heard of stingray. How many people here heard of stingray? Very few. But what stingray is a technology that DEA and the feds don't tell you about. They don't even tell the judges about it. And they don't believe that they need warrants to use stingray. And stingray is basically a tracking device. And it was developed on the war on terrorism. This is a byproduct, and it's now trickled down to the DEA. And of course, they always say in the Patriot Act, we're not using this for drug traffickers. We're only using this for terrorists, right? Isn't that what we always hear? Bullshit. They're using it for the drug guys. And so what I do is I file a very long and detailed discovery motion asking for as much information as I can about all the different DEA surveillance and stingray. And needless to say, that case got dismissed. So my client, her sitting in jail for about 6 months, and I talked to the state prosecutor about it, and she is a very nice person, and I asked her about it, and she said, I tried to get this information, the DEA just shut me down, so I had no choice. I had to dismiss it. And so the point that I was trying to make out of that is that you have to be able to dig. You have to use the smell test, and I don't mean the dogs. I mean, you have to use the smell test. When things don't smell right, when there are things that happen and there are no explanations for them, for example, randomly picking out the van as it crossed the border, you have to start wondering what is going on, what's going on behind the scenes. And the things that I can tell you is going behind the scenes that I found out is that DEA does a lot of stuff that there's no way that they're turning over to the prosecutors unless you have to go there, you have to get a court order, and you have to ask for it. And you are entitled to this information. One of the things that I have found out through my litigation of drug cases is what DEA does for almost every action they do, they have what they call a DEA operational plan. Has anybody heard of those? One person. It's because nobody knows about it. Two people. DEA, and I'm wondering, David, did you ever, when you're dealings with all the drug people and the drug cases where you have the interdiction, did you ever hear about the DEA operational plan?
Operational what?
They call them DEA operational plans.
No, I've never heard that phrase.
Okay, well, what? And it's for good reason, because they don't reveal them. And they're heavily what they like to call classified, or they won't reveal them. And you have to specifically ask for them. And I can guarantee you, when you ask for them, the government's going to say, well, we have to have an in-camera We have to have an in-camera examination before we're going to release them because there's all kinds of sensitive information that's in it. And the way that I learned that was, again, going through another hearing. I had a two-day hearing on suppression on an illegal arrest. My client was in a car with another person who they thought was a, who they actually knew, who they had set up on a controlled buy of 10 pounds of meth. And I believed it was an illegal arrest, that they had no evidence on my guy, and I also believe that my guy was not the source of the meth coming into Colorado that the government believed he was. So there was a two-day suppression hearing where I subpoenaed the DEA agents, I subpoenaed the cops, I subpoenaed everybody that was even named in any of the police reports, and I brought him into court. And the judge, who's Judge Martinez here in Denver, allowed me to turn that into a two-day discovery hearing, where I learned all kinds of great stuff about what the DEA was doing and what they weren't turning over. And it was great. And what I did is I got Judge Martinez during the hearing to issue an oral order to the government, because I didn't know anything about these operational plans either. I had never heard of them either. And all of a sudden, the DEA guy goes, oh yeah, well, before we do anything, we institute an operational plan. And they have a little meeting at their clubhouse, and they all sit down, and they all talk about what everybody's going to do, and they write it all out.
So your witness at the discovery hearing was the DEA agent?
Yeah.
Anybody else?
I had all the cops, so all the task force people, so they were all local and feds, who, in Colorado, they had these joint task force, where they have local cops working with the federal cops. And so, and one of the guys that I subpoenaed in was the guy who was the head of this local task force. And he's the guy that did these operational meetings and put together these operational plans.
And he was a DEA agent, not a crossover.
Actually, I think he was a crossover, but he was actually working for DEA at the time. He wasn't working for the local agency.
Good job.
And he was, and then, so he starts talking about this operational plan, and I go, I turn to the U.S. attorney and go, Judge, I go, wait a minute, I don't have this operational plan. And the judge goes, the judge gets interested. And the judge starts asking him about the operational plans. And then he gets into this whole thing about the operational plans and how everything is laid out, and it's greatly detailed. And so all of a sudden, I'm like getting an order from Judge Martinez saying, I want to see those operational plans, and I want them turned over to Mr. Melovitz. And so the U.S. attorney goes, well, can we do an in-chambers thing? I'll give you an unredacted one and a redacted one. And Judge, the one I want turned over is going to be the redacted one, so a few things were blacked out. I said, I can live with that. I don't care. And so not only did I get the DEA operational plan for that particular arrest, but I got the DEA operational plans on every single time they had done a control buy or done anything with the guy who was the drug dealer who they had said was, my guy was his source, which was, had gone back 8 months. I got 8 months of DEA operational plans on every time that DEA had any kind of control buy. And they were doing tons of control buys with this guy where he was selling them large quantities. Or my guy wasn't even in the picture. He wasn't even in the state. He wasn't even in the country, actually. He was in Mexico. And because our theory of our defense was that my guy wasn't the source. This guy had been dealing for a long time. My guy just happened to be in the car with the guy when he got busted. And my guy was just an innocent bystander. And so you learn by doing these hearings. You can turn suppression hearings. You can turn preliminary hearings, you can turn detention hearings into discovery devices, and you have to do that because there is so much out there. And the thing that you have to remember is that DEA, as Ed said, they are a law unto themselves. They don't care about warrants. They don't care about, because the judges never slap them down. That's the reason why. They don't care. They will do it. And they will do whatever they think. They believe that the ends justify the means. And so you have to be able to analyze the situation. You have to analyze what's going on. You have to be able to analyze the discovery that you do get. And you have to figure out living in the world of paranoia, as a good criminal defense attorney does, I think, you have to figure out, why did they actually come down on my guy the way they did? Why did this arrest happen? Why did this traffic stop happen? Because it absolutely makes no sense otherwise. So there is always stuff out there. And what I did is I went down, in my outline, I wrote a list of things that I always look for whenever I get a case, especially a drug case, and especially where there's an arrest or a traffic stop. And wiretaps, GPS trackers, incredibly important. You have to look at the GPS trackers, and you also have to look when the warrant was issued for the tracker, if there was a warrant. I've had cases where they've slapped GPS trackers on vehicles without warrants. What was the name of that case a couple years ago where Scalia ruled that they had that, where the warrant had expired, I believe, and they still had the tracker on? You know which one I'm talking about?
Jones,
right. I had that, a very similar case, only this is what happened in my case. The narcs suspected that my guy was going to use a pickup truck for 100-pound mushroom transportation the next day. So what they did was they slapped the track, and this is in Boulder. You have to remember, Boulder's right up against the foothills, right? So all my clients said, they're all up in the mountains. None of them do anything in Boulder, because it's too hot in Boulder. But in the mountains, you can find little houses to rent or to buy, where you can do whatever you want, and nobody really knows what you're up to. So anyway, they had set up a 100-pound mushroom buy, and the cops, and they suspected that this pickup truck that was owned by my client was going to be the truck that was going to be used to transport the 100 pounds the next day. So what they did that night, they went and they slapped a GPS tracker on it. And they then they went and got the warrant after they put the tracker on it. I'm like going, really, guys? And again, I didn't know this till I did the suppression hearing. It was nowhere in the discovery. So I'm like, and the cop goes, oh yeah, we do this all the time. The DA told us we could. Yeah. I'm like going, huh? You know, so their rationale is they don't start monitoring it till they get the warrant. And so between the time that my client was arrested and the time we went to the suppression hearing, Jones came down. And needless to say, we got 100 pounds of mushrooms suppressed.
Yeah.
And my client walked away with a little slap on the wrist. And there, I must say, I had a prosecutor who was, I've known him for a long time. He's a very decent guy. And he was intellectually challenged, as well as I was, by whether or not this was legal or not. Because he was actually the prosecutor that was telling the cops you could do this. So we had our, and because a lot of times in Boulder and in a lot of the jurisdictions around Denver, you'll get this thing from the DAs, if we have to go to a suppression hearing, if we have to bring our cops in, no offers, it's off the table. So basically the suppression hearing becomes the trial. This particular DA wasn't going there. He was like going, yeah, it's a very interesting question. I want to know what the answer is. And so I was going, yeah, so do I. So we had this hearing, and luckily for us, Jones came down about a month before our hearing. And the judge followed Jones, and we got that whole shipment suppressed. So what you...
Antoine Jones ultimately was convicted.
Was he really?
Yeah, because they tried him without the GPL thing.
And that's
you did a better job.
Well, not really. I just got lucky. And
lucky there was no binding appellate authority prior to Jones in your jurisdiction.
I had a brave judge too, and that was the other thing too. And so to me, Scalia. I mean, everybody rips on Scalia. They go, oh, he's crazy. You know, he's bad for the defense. Scalia is my hero. Jones, great decision. He was the main backing force in Gaul. I think that if you know how to approach Scalia and you know how to angle your argument, he's very receptive to it. And what he's receptive to is he's receptive to judges being able to do what they want to do, which was gall. The trial judges should have the autonomy to do what they think is right. And in Jones, I think it was really a matter of privacy. Scalia is a big dude on privacy when it's right.
When it's property.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look at the dog smell case that came out of Florida. Right. Yes.
Oops. Well, I mean, all of this is well and good, but cops can easily just amend their reports to make this more and more secret. Like, for example, they can rely on the randomness of just a justified traffic stop on the I-70, right? Someone going over 5. Well, most judges are just asking, was there reasonable suspicion? Was there an observed traffic stop, right? If there was, since pretext stops are okay nowadays, then that's the only insight. So the problem is with technology getting, this is child play, trackers and GPS trackers and wiretap, Title III wiretaps are a joke compared to what we know the NSA can discover. And all the police reporter has to do is leave that part out and start the stop. So how do we mutually combat that? Because that's the real scenario that I've been seeing all the time, and one that we really can't get at.
Well, I think that's a really good question. And being an attorney, I'm going to dodge that question. Because that's not really what I'm concerned with. I'm concerned with how can you twist it and use that to your advantage in your case. I get what you're saying, because I agree. I mean, you know, it's kind of like the nuclear arms race, right? I mean, there's a technology, we learn about it, the next thing we know, they've got a more advanced technology. And this is like, and that actually kind of leads to my next point, which is how do you stay on top of this stuff? But I understand what you're saying, and I think it's really, you know, it's left to the politicians. We can't control that. What we can control is what we can do is we can use what shenanigans DEA and other government agencies are up to that they're not obtaining warrants for. And the one thing I found out, especially federal judges, they hate it when people like DEA, when organizations like that go behind their back and violate the Fourth Amendment without going to them. Not that they're not going to give them the warrant if they'd ask, but the fact is they don't bother to ask and they don't do it, and that pisses them off, right? So what you do is you use that to your advantage, and you use that to put the pressure on the government to give you a better deal. It's not something that's necessarily going to mean you're going to win the case. I mean, win is relative. You know.
And I understand those basic tactics, but still, if they're not relying on this super surveillance information, how do you discover it?
Well, that's...
Nor mentioned anywhere, which is, I think, the more common thing. I mean, or at least they're going to be taught to do that really quickly every time there's a suppression on an issue, like, hey, don't put the GPS thing in for good.
Right, and a lot of it's just blind, dumb luck. But a lot of it is also things that just don't add up. Like, when you get a DEA guy up on the witness stand, he's testifying under oath, well, it's just randomness that we happen to see this van cross the border. Well, anyone that has any experience going on I-70 at that border knows that you'd have to sit there and, you know, just count cars for days, you know, to randomly happen to hit this van. Yes?
Aren't there license plate readers nowadays that are networked?
I think so. And right, I mean, they do have license plate readers, and that's how they use it on the toll roads. But if you're on a toll lane and you don't use your, if you're there illegally or whatever, that's how they catch you and send you the ticket, is because they're actually reading your license plate.
They actually like that because they charge you an extra fee.
That's right, because you don't have the transponder. But so far, the cops aren't doing that. I mean, I haven't seen that yet, but I'm sure that's the next thing that's, you know, they're going to be using that. I don't know. You know, I can certainly see. I was thinking. Well, actually, what I was thinking about when Dave, when you were talking about your case in Utah, where the cop, you know, they did the license plate didn't come up on their computer. I mean, I think that, you know, that's the technology now that they're using. They're using the video technology to take pictures of those plates. Those plates then translate somehow onto their computers, and they can run those plates like that. In other words, nobody needs to type that plate in anymore. It's already there. Yes?
Were you able to establish their use of Stingray in that case?
No, because they won't reveal it. They dumped the case rather than go forward. I mean, they did a lot of things. I mean, I could tell you stories about DEA just missing stuff that was obvious, like right in front of you. Like, for example, in that 10-pound meth case, when they arrested my client and the guy who was had sold the 10 pounds to the confidential informant, they gave him their cell phones back. They never even bothered to confiscate their cell phones, and they gave them, and then these two guys gave them to the other guy's girlfriend, and those cell phones disappeared. I mean, I was like amazed when they didn't take that, because they believed that there were calls being made all over the country into Mexico regarding.
Do you think there has to be a DEA or a federal agent running the Stingray equipment, or are they loaning it to local agencies? Are they running?
Well, I think there's so much crossover right now that I think it depends on the type of operation that you're talking about. My operation went from California through Utah into Colorado, Nevada, Utah. So it was a multi-state investigation, and that pretty much, whenever I see multi-state, I'm like thinking DEA, there's some federal component to it. The one where the 100 pounds of mushrooms in Boulder County, it was drug task force, but there was no indication that there were any federal involvement in that. In fact, I was thanking my lucky stars that the feds didn't get involved in that, because that would have been a much different battle had we actually had to litigate that in federal court and state court. But I think that what you have to do is, and one of the things that you have to remember is a lot of this technology has evolved from what's going on in Iraq, what's going on in Afghanistan, and what's going on here in the U.S. in the fight against terrorism. So a lot of these cops, they're in the military. And they're learning this technology when they're in the military, and then they're coming back to their local police departments, and they're doing the same stuff. One of the most fascinating things that I found out and was that there's now this radar that they can actually see through walls with. It's amazing, the stuff, the technology that they're coming up with. And that kind of leads me to my next point. How do you find out about this stuff? How do you find out about this technology? The internet is a great resource, but one of the best resources that I found for finding out about different kinds of government surveillance and what's going on is LinkedIn. There's two groups in LinkedIn that are extremely, extremely on top of this kind of stuff and are consistently putting out studies, and they're finding cases, and it's the White Collar Law Group and the Innocence Project.
Do that again.
The White Collar Crime Group, or it's either White Collar Crime or White Collar Criminal Defense Attorneys. If you and there's actually a guy in Houston that writes extensively about this, and I spoke to him about this. He's an ex-federal prosecutor who's now a defense attorney. I think his name is Glenn Davis, and Glenn writes. There's probably two or three blurbs a day from him. He's on top of this. He's on top of all the newest surveillance stuff. He's on top of what the government's doing. And because he's an ex-U.S. attorney, he knows where to go to find this stuff. And he turned me on to actually the DOJ website for U.S. attorneys. There's a manual and policies and procedures that they have to follow. And that is actually online, and you can find it. And you can find exactly what they have to do and what they're supposed to be following for these types of situations, like the type of situation that I just talked about, like in the 10-pound meth case, because that was a federal case. And those things are, there's so much information. And it's a game where we're constantly playing catch-up, but these guys that are really into it and really looking at the surveillance stuff, especially in the White Collar Criminal Defense LinkedIn group. Those guys are excellent. Those guys are finding up. That's how I found out about this, through the wall radar stuff, where they can be outside a house and they can tell you who's in the house, what's going on, where are people moving, everything. Yes?
Yeah, it's hyperspectral imaging. But the reality of it, I think there was a court case, AT&T, maybe it was AT&T versus the FCC. The reality of it is that we don't have any privacy when it comes to communications. And so it's just easier to assume. I mean, I don't agree with it. I'm just saying that the reality of it is that the NSA intercepts all the communications through the hubs. And the court case got started over this guy who worked for AT&T. It was like, what is this room in this building? And they're like, oh, don't worry about it. Well, so everything is, it's from what I understand. And the courts ruled that they're allowed. Like, I think AT&T, I'm pretty sure, sued. Like, or there was a lawsuit about it. And so it says that they can basically intercept. So it's just easier to assume that we don't have a right to communications privacy in terms of keeping out of trouble.
Well, that's certainly what the government agents figure. We don't have a right, and they don't have to go to court to get the warrant.
But I agree with you.
We're going to talk tomorrow, but 3 weeks ago, the Second Circuit held that the NSA's data collection, it violates the Patriot Act, Section 215, which, by the way, is up for grabs on Sunday. It may actually expire. It doesn't deal with the private companies that collect this information, but it does hold that they have no right to the bulk collection of that information. They don't reach the constitutional issue. They just hold that it doesn't violate Section 215 of the Patriot Act.
And if I could just add, there's another great resource out there, and that's the ACLU. The ACLU right now has at least one, if not more, Freedom of Information Act lawsuits going on. One is out of the Northern District of California. I've been trying to reach the attorney that's litigating that lawsuit. But they've been getting some favorable rulings under the Freedom of Information Act regarding Stingray and other devices that the government's using. And if you go and you get those filings, those would be extremely helpful. Yes?
Mark, when you asked who knows what Stingray is, I did not raise my hand because I don't know. At the risk of ruining my day, could you tell me shortly about what Stingray is?
Yeah, Stingray basically uses cell phone technology. And it's a much more sophisticated system than just cell tower tracking, where it can basically give you all the information off the cell phone.
It's cell tower spoofing, right?
It is. It can spoof. It can do a lot of stuff. I mean, it's a really sophisticated...
It mimics
a
cell tower.
It is a cell tower. It doesn't mimic a cell tower. It's a micro cell tower.
Right, so they're getting all the information.
It doesn't mimic it. It's a micro cell tower that basically you connect to the one that's closest and most powerful.
It has higher power than the others around. So it goes.
Yeah, they're violating SEC rules to be able to roll that out.
Right, and so when the original cell tower thing was, they could say, well, we knew this person was in this area because this cell tower gave us this information to the person's location. Stingray takes it a lot further. It gives a lot more information. There's also technology out there where they can listen in to your conversations if you have the right kind of cell phone without your cell phone even being powered on. So tell all your drug dealer clients, get rid of your cell phones. But
And if you turn off all your tracking on your phone, there's algorithms now that can read your battery. How the percentage of your battery is decreasing and actually figure out where you are.
Exactly. And you can expect the technology to just get more and more sophisticated because, like I said, it's like the nuclear arms race. As soon as we learn about something like Stingray, as soon as we learn about something else, they're coming up with new technologies. Yes?
This is a softball question. What was the name of the officer, the DEA agent who revealed the standard operational plans?
You know, I'm sorry, I can't. I was left upstairs in the smoking lounge too much last night to remember his specific name. But if you contact me at my office, I can get you that information. He's out of the Springs.
Out of the Springs.
Yeah, this whole operation was a Pueblo Springs operation. But there's a question over there.
1 week ago, a very sophisticated white collar lawyer was representing a RICO conspiracy of which we have a co-defendant. They made an agreement with the clerk of the court to surrender the guy. He had previously been bonded out from the Central District of California. And the lawyer was telling me yesterday that what happened was the guy came up to San Francisco and was going to turn himself in. The clerk put on the calendar, magistrate clerk put on the calendar, and she was going to go in on 9 o'clock the next day. We do this all the time. Turns out that the marshals get an emergency GPS warrant or something. They immediately activate it and they go at gunpoint to the lawyer's office looking for this guy in the middle of town. And then they couldn't find him because they couldn't activate the GPS to get to the lawyer's office, which is on the 22nd floor. They continue to track this guy's cell phone, and they find out the hotel that he was living in, big hotel in San Francisco. They go with their guns drawn, they knock on the door, and they arrest him with drawn guns because he had his cell phone, and they GPS
I know, and the technology is amazing. And the thing that's really...
By the way, that's Michael's opinion. For those of you who haven't had the pleasure, make sure you're here at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, because he's going to start us off.
But 9 o'clock, you're going to hear about ethics.
Right.
I'm sure you can't wait for that.
By the way, they're going to take an hour of ethics off your CLE.
That's the only reason they're coming. I know that.
But you're exactly right, though. I mean, the Fugitive Task Force, they have one in Denver, where they people are amazed. They're going, how did they locate me? You know, and they locate them because they're using Stingray. They're using other tracking devices. They're using things, and the weapon that we can use, if we can find out the technology that they're using, there's a very high likelihood that they never went to a judge to get a warrant to use it. I would say, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, I would just be guessing, but I would, in almost every case that I've come across where they've used this, they've either dumped the case, when I've even asked for information regarding that, they've either dumped the case completely, or they've given my client deals that they couldn't refuse because they were too good. For example, in the 10-pound meth case I just told you about, my guy was a 2-time loser, and whoever does federal law drug cases knows that if you're a 2-time loser and you're in the federal system, you're looking at a life sentence that's mandatory. And they filed a sentencing enhancer against my client. They just offered us, a week before trial, they offered us a deal with a 5-year cap. And my client took it like that. You know, he didn't want to roll the dice on a life sentence. But the point I'm trying to make is just as a matter of course, you have to file that motion to preserve right away. You have to put the right notice in it, and then you have to start digging and use the hearings. The hearings are critical. And just like you said, you know, in that one hearing where I had the DEA agent testify under oath, that it was just random dumb luck. Well, the DEA knew that it wasn't random dumb luck, and they knew that he had just perjured himself. And so you can use that as leverage to get a favorable outcome in your case. It's not necessarily something that's going to win the case for you in a legal sense where you're going to go in and win a suppression motion, although it might, and you don't know, but it's something that you can use as leverage. The prosecutors don't want to give that stuff up. The DEA certainly doesn't want to give that stuff up, and you can use that. And every once in a while, you do get a U.S. attorney that will just get so disgusted at DEA, they'll dump the case, not because DA not because the stuff is sensitive and they don't want to turn it over, but because they get sick and tired of the DEA shenanigans. And they'll find, if you get a court order and the U.S. attorney has to go to the DA and says turn it over, that's happened to me in the past, where the DEA has fought the U.S. attorney and refused to turn over information. And it was a U.S. attorney in Denver named Dave Connor. Dave was a really good guy. And Dave called me up and he said, Mark, I'm dismissing the case. I said, thanks, Dave, why are you doing it? And he said, because the DEA won't do what I'm asked, what the judge is telling him to do and what I'm telling him to do. So I'm just dumping the case. Now my guy had sat in jail for a year and a half, so it wasn't like he didn't get some punishment, but the point is that you have to aggressively go after this information. Because if you don't, my estimation is, you're doing a disservice to your client and you're also probably committing malpractice. You need to be able to go there. You need to be able to really fight really hard for this information. It's out there, or if it's not out there, it's kind of like being in a dark room without a light and you don't know what's in that room. And you're going to get a lot of pushback by judges. You're going to get, what's the one term the government always uses? They're just on a fishing expedition, right? You know, just cite all the cases and show the government. And you're going to get some judges that will, you're going to get some judges that are going to not give you what you want, but you're also going to get some judges that are going to. And you have to do that whenever you get a case where you have any kind of inkling, any kind of indication, especially in drug cases where there's been a long term of surveillance and there's travel or there's a stop on a road, there's a very high probability, very high likelihood that they've been using some type of surveillance that they're not revealing. And at a minimum, if there's any kind of DEA coordination, get that operational plan. You have to ask for that operational plan, because that operational plan opens up just a ton of more questions that you can find out about what type of surveillance was taking place, what the depth of their investigation is, and if nothing else, you learn all the different agents that were involved. And a lot of times you'll get names of agents that weren't involved that aren't on the discovery, that never wrote reports, and their names never appear in the reports. So all I can say to you is what Groucho Marx once said to somebody: I never want to be a member of a club that would have me as a member, but I'm glad to be a member of this club. Thank you very much.